Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
They will also be listening to consumers, the parents who are trying to find that child care center close to home.
The Dunleavy administration establishes a child care task force. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Tuluksac receives state assistance more than a month after the water line to the school broke.
Now we are able to guarantee all students and the elders in the community daily meals.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
A Wasilla man sentenced for storming the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, is asking a judge to loosen a condition of his probation. He wants to be allowed a firearm to protect himself from moose. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
A federal judge in Washington, D.C. sentenced 43-year-old Aaron James Miller to 2 years of probation last month for demonstrating or parading in the Capitol building. Three other charges were dismissed in exchange for his guilty plea. Not possessing firearms was a condition of probation. But Miller's D.C.-based lawyer then filed a request that his client be allowed to possess his rifle to defend his life and property. Assistant Federal Public Defender Eugene Ohm wrote that within days of his sentencing hearing, Miller saw a moose on his property. He included photos of Miller's backyard moose. Moose can be dangerous, Ohm wrote. Federal prosecutors oppose the request. They say Miller lives in a suburb, not the wilds, and that moose rarely need to be shot in self-defense. The question is pending before District Court Judge Randolph Moss. Miller was arrested after someone tipped off the FBI that he'd posted video on Facebook showing himself inside the Capitol during the riot. The sentencing documents shed a bit more light on the case. Miller, who installs roof gutters, was in Baltimore on January 6 visiting a cousin. By their own account, they were among the first throng to enter the building from the East Plaza of the Capitol. The riot interrupted the certification of the Electoral College vote. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Governor Mike Dunleavy announced a new task force today to look at the availability and affordability of child care in Alaska. He says access to affordable child care is crucial to the state's economy and well-being. Across the state, the child care market is tight and expensive, costing parents an average of 14 to 17% of their annual income in Anchorage, according to the Alaska Children's Trust.
It's a real issue that needs to be looked at and scrutinized so that we can come up with some models that that can help our folks, our families, our mothers.
Dunleavy signed an administrative order establishing the task force, which will be made up of state officials plus representatives from tribal, nonprofit, military, and other child care programs. There's also a spot for a parent who has experience in finding child care in Alaska. State Health Commissioner Heidi Hedberg says the goal is to improve the availability, affordability, and quality of child care across the state.
The task force will be looking at existing strategic plans, assessments, surveys. They will also be listening to consumers, the parents who are trying to find that child care center close to home.
She says the group will deliver an initial report with findings and recommendations to the governor by the end of the year, with a final report at the end of July 2024. State lawmakers are also working to address the availability of child care options. Anchorage Democratic Representative Zach Fields says the proposals include appropriating $15 million to support existing child care providers.
1,700 child care providers earning on average around $14.50 per hour. you know, you could go get a job at Target tomorrow earning $20 an hour with benefits. $15 million is enough to raise those wages, stabilize the labor force, stop hemorrhaging childcare workers.
Dunleavy opposes the injection of state money, calling it a, quote, knee-jerk reaction.
I'm not going to support $50 million in childcare because we don't even know what the childcare is we're talking about. What does it look like? Is it focused on infants? Is it focused on toddlers? Is it focused on other age groups?
Some childcare advocates say the money is necessary. Stephanie Berglund is CEO of Thread, a childcare advocacy group. She says the money from COVID-19 relief that supported childcare was effective in keeping the industry afloat, and similar state investments should continue.
The sector is really fragile and needs additional support. So we're confident that childcare needs more investment now, whether it's this year or, you know, aligned with the policy recommendations that we're hopeful for out of this task force. But we know the dollars can't come soon enough, and we encourage investment now.
Both Berglund and Fields say they support the task force and hope it helps to inform legislation and government action to address the state's shortage of affordable childcare. A group of University of Alaska graduate student workers trying to form a union marched on the campus last Friday. They're following a nationwide trend of student workers organizing. KUAC's Robin reports.
Hey, grad students!
The Alaska Labor Relations Agency received a petition from the Alaska Graduate Workers Association in February. The group proposes to represent 530 UA system graduate student workers who are paid a stipend or a teaching assistant wage. Association steering committee member Derek Arnold says they recently sent cards to all prospective union members to gauge their interest.
We recently got our card count, so that was the first step, was to get our card count, a showing of interest. We got the showing of interest done. It's been certified by the ALRA, the Alaska Labor Relations Agency.
Katya Berghaus is also on the steering committee.
There's a lot of student support. Everybody really wants us to move to the voting stage right now and showing the university system that we are still committed to this.
Compensation and health care are top issues for the union. Another Alaska Graduate Workers Association member, Victor Devo-Shupin, says unionization is a way to attract more talent, especially to the mother campus.
The UAF, it has an international renown for the science it does. It's literally in the interest of everybody for this to happen because you have happy grad students, you have good publicity, and it's hard to convince grad students to come here because Fairbanks is already a harsh place. What makes the core Fairbanks is the people and the relationship that we have. Otherwise, the place, it's pretty, but it's a harsh environment.
Many grad students are paid out of research grants. But Berghaus says the UA system extracts overhead fees to administer the grants.
The university makes a big win with us. Having more students means more money for the university. The more attractive the university is, the more students that come here, the more money the university will have.
The unit would be part of the UAW, the United Auto Workers Union. They now represent about 19,000 student workers across the country. Arnold says this local unit is part of that nationwide trend.
We're actually the only R1, R2 research institution on the West Coast that doesn't have a graduate student union, so I think in that regard we're quite a ways behind.
Arnold says one of the things the association wants most for graduate students is participation in policy.
We want to be part of the process. You know, we want to have a voice in decisions that are made, and currently we can, you know, people can get worked up. We can have a lot of people put in a lot of effort to try to get a problem addressed, but number one, it's optional, you know? They don't have to listen to us. And number two, that's a lot of responsibility to put on grad students, and this makes it so we are iteratively part of the process all the time.
The next step is a two-week period where the university can object to the unionization. If there is no objection from the UA administration, the association will hold a vote to unionize. If a union is certified, it can begin negotiations with the university for a contract. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, federal funds are headed to Alaska to combat climate change.
Rising water levels and soil erosion are forcing folks to make some impossible choices about relocating their homes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. If you are experiencing domestic violence or feel unsafe, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is here for you. Call 1-844-762-8483 or visit strongheartshelpline.org. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Three Alaska Native tribes have sued to block what would be one of the largest gold mines in the world. They argue that federal agencies failed to properly analyze health and environmental concerns for the Donlin Gold Project in southwest Alaska. Tribes from the communities of Kwikset, Tuluksak, and Bethel filed a federal lawsuit Wednesday challenging the adequacy of a 2018 environmental review by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It also challenges issuances of a key permit and lease by federal agencies for the project. The mine's backers say the lawsuit is without merit. Well, after several weeks of waiting, Tuluksak is getting support from the state. In early February, a line leading from the community's water plant to the school broke, leaving the school and teacher housing without running water. KYUK's Francisco Martinez-Cuello reports.
Tuluksak school principal Carrie Del Signore says district staff now have a reliable vehicle to haul water as they truck it from the water plant to the school's tanks. She says that the school has also received shelf-stable meals from the Alaska Food Bank and drinking water for students and staff.
Now we are able to guarantee our students and the elders in the community daily meals, and again, very thankful for their help with that.
Without the state support, Del Signore says they would not have been able to continue to keep the school open and serve the community and students.
We still face the struggle of making sure that the village pipe is repaired so that we can actually restore running water to the school building. So that is the next thing that we'll be working on.
Del Signore is hopeful that a contractor will come and repair the line after the spring thaw and restore running water to the school building.
Barring any other issues, we are kind of holding our own and able to keep the school building functioning and serve our students.
The school is also loaning fuel to the Tuluksak community, and the state will supplement the fuel supply until a barge can come in.
And so that will be part of the disaster aid that they supply to us, so we don't have to worry about fuel right now.
Del Signore says the students are doing well and back to their regular routine of attending classes.
We're really pleased. We have students traveling to NYO. We've been able to have sports practice. All of those things are, you know, crucial to keeping our students engaged and involved in school.
The support couldn't have come at a better time. The students are in the middle of state testing. In Bethel, I'm Francisco Martinez-Cuello.
Willapa Bay in southwest Washington is the self-styled oyster capital of the world. But can it hold its crown? Shellfish growers on the bay are alarmed by an invasion of non-native European green crabs. They want more action against what is a coast-wide problem. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from the waters of Willapa Bay.
Okay, there we have some green crab right off the bat.
Warren Cowell owns Willapa Bay Shellfish. He and other oyster and clam growers are hunting down invasive European green crabs.
14, 16.
On the state's dime, Cowell's crew hauls up and empties dozens 17. Of traps placed around the commercial clam and oyster beds offshore of Nakata, Washington. The square mesh traps come up, filled mostly with juvenile native Dungeness crabs, but sprinkled in are darker-colored, slightly differently shaped green crabs. Crew member Nico Hora sorts by hand and tosses the native Dungeness back, all the while trying not to get pinched.
Yeah, that's why I have to be careful with it, especially with the Dungeness. The green crab, they don't pinch you that hard, but Dungeness will.
The crew collected 109 green crabs in less than 2 hours.
And that's it.
With over a year of trapping, our numbers still are very high.
Encouragingly, though, it's down from a peak seen last fall. The undesirable European green crabs will be frozen to death and then sent to a landfill. Cowell says the state's trapping numbers show the shallow, sheltered saltwater bay has become a hot spot for the invasive green crabs.
So they'll eat all the shellfish if they get established and move on to everything else that they can eat, all the habitat, the eelgrass, which is so important, and they even take that out eventually. So what's at stake here is Willapaw Bay as a whole, the whole ecosystem and everything that it contributes.
According to the Pacific Shellfish Institute, Washington State is by far the largest producer of Manila clams in the U.S. and a leading producer of oysters. More than two-thirds of the state's oysters come from Willapaw Bay. The shellfish industry is the largest private employer in Pacific County, too. State biologists and the local growers say crab trapping is presently the only way to control the invaders that threaten that bounty. Cowell is calling for a trapping blitz this year.
We're at the tipping point if we haven't passed it. And so we have to trap and trap as aggressively as we possibly can, at least to hold the line until we can come up with better solutions.
Which is along the lines of how the state Fish and Wildlife Department is thinking about this. Alan Plois is the state's aquatic invasive species manager. He says his agency has spare traps and is hiring more seasonal help this year to protect specific high-value sites. They've also hired a research scientist to target green crabs.
This is a problem that's going to persist for a long time, and we're looking at long-term solutions. What are the genetic possibilities for creating, you know, like sterile males or, you know, some other method that we could use?
Plois says local control seems possible, but eradication at the statewide level is not a realistic goal because ocean currents are constantly resupplying green crab larvae from afar.
They get repopulated by larvae coming from the south and coming from the north, and there's just no bottleneck for that larvae.
While Washington and British Columbia are battling the European crabs, Oregon's Department of Fish and Wildlife is taking a different tack. They're just monitoring and letting recreational crabbers go after them. The invaders are edible, but have little meat in their shells and don't grow as large as Dungeness crabs, so they're generating minimal interest from sports fishers. Oregon's shellfish program leader says several state agencies are now trying to figure out if Oregon should begin an active control effort, too. I'm Tom Bonsi in Nakata, Washington.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. If you are experiencing domestic violence or feel unsafe, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is here for you. Call 1-844-762-8483 or visit strongheartshelpline.org. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The State Division of Forestry has cleared a wide swath of trees and vegetation from a fire-prone area west of Delta Junction. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, it's one of several fuel breaks that forestry has cleared to protect other communities around the state from wildfire.
Forestry Division crews used earth movers and other equipment last winter while the ground was frozen to clear a 300-foot-wide, 13-mile-long swath of forest west of the Delta River. That's where several big wildfires have burned in recent years, like the Oregon Lakes fire that blackened 35,000 acres in 2019.
That area has got a frequent fire history, a combination of fire starts and then the wind. That's just an area of concern for us.
Norm McDonald heads up forestry's Fairbanks-based fire and aviation operations. And he says agency officials have long considered cutting a fuel break in the area to help crews fight the wildfires. And the Oregon Lakes fire and increase state and federal funding for wildfire prevention motivated them to get the job done.
It gives us a toehold, a place where we can safely put firefighters to protect whatever values that we identified.
That toehold is the 349-acre fuel break west of the Delta River and Delta Junction on state land near military training areas that are littered with unexploded bombs and other ordnance.
We know it was used actively by the military for training, and we know there's unexploded ordnance out there, so we have not and we will not put firefighters in there.
There also are cabins scattered around the area and the faith-based Whitestone community, where about 60 people live. The area is vulnerable to wildfires, sometimes sparked by military training, that can spread quickly through dry, dense vegetation, often driven by high winds.
So having a pre-identified or pre-established fuels break in that area just makes a lot of sense.
McDonald says forestry hopes to begin work on the bigger phase two of the project late next year. He says it's one of several fuel reduction efforts the agency's planning statewide.
We've got projects going in Fairbanks and Kenai and Anchorage and Massu Valley.
McDonald says state and federal fire officials believe fuel reduction projects are more important than ever now that climate change has made wildfire seasons start earlier and last longer with larger and more destructive fires. And he says fuel breaks offer another benefit in the form of firewood.
We found people are excited to have a fuels break. It protects their community, but they're also really excited to have a place to get firewood.
McDonald says area residents can contact their local forestry office to find out how to apply for a permit to pick up firewood left over from the project after it's completed. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The state of Alaska recently received $38 million from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. KMXT's Brian Venwa reports the money is aimed to ease the burden of climate change.
Margaret Salazar is HUD's Northwest Regional Administrator. She oversees HUD's programs around Alaska, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Last week, she attended Arctic Encounter, the largest annual Arctic policy event in the country, where she made the announcement. Salazar says the new funding is to help villages get ahead of natural disasters.
We're helping folks work upstream with things like technical assistance to start planning ahead for housing development, as opposed to just funding the sticks and bricks part of housing supply.
The money was made available through the Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Program, or CDBGDR funds. These funds are aimed at helping communities better rebound from presidentially declared disasters, but Salazar says the state will be allowed to allocate the new funds for preventative measures.
Now, when the state of Alaska, who's our grantee, when they get those dollars, they can use some of them for that planning work. So this is brand new policy that we've rolled out.
Salazar says she hopes funding plans before they become disasters can help ease the burden of climate change.
Village relocation and rising water levels and soil erosion are forcing folks to make some impossible choices about relocating their homes. And one of the exciting opportunities we have right now is the opportunity for HUD to align and join forces with our other federal agency partners.
Some of the departments she listed included the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Energy, and the Department of Transportation. But climate change isn't the only issue Alaskans face when it comes to housing. Unlike communities on the road system, folks in Bush, Alaska can't commute for work, so housing can be a limiting factor for growth. Salazar says her trip to Kodiak last week gave her a new perspective on the issues Alaskans face when compared to their rural counterparts in the lower 48.
What we see and we heard today in Kodiak was just the lack of being able to expand economic opportunities because of a lack of housing. So if we can't find ways to house our folks, we can't find ways to expand job opportunities, and it becomes a cycle.
But developing new housing is especially difficult for communities that aren't directly connected to Anchorage. Rural communities often face high costs for shipping, difficulty accessing building supplies, and even finding workers to do the construction. To reduce some of the barriers local governments face, Salazar says HUD also approved new grants to help them work out regulations that prevent housing development.
So whether it's things like zoning or building codes or permitting process, you know, we can come to the table and be a partner in terms of federal dollars, but we want to make sure that the local folks are doing their work to have a plan ready, to have shovel-ready dirt, so that when we can fund housing development, we can get that done quickly.
And while she praised local entities like the Kodiak Island and Cook Inlet Housing Authorities, Salazar says there's still more work to do and looks forward to continuing partnerships with entities around the state. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venwa.
After 50 years of operation, Juneau's Augustus Brown Pool has closed for major renovations. City Aquatics Manager Tara Patterson described some of the upcoming improvements on Juneau Afternoon last week.
The recreation pool will be resurfaced. We're getting new electric plumbing. The locker rooms, I think, are probably the biggest piece that people will notice the most. So the locker rooms are being completely renovated.
But one part of the locker rooms will live on in a new art installation, the tiles painted in 1999 by Juno Kids. KTOO's Katie Anastas visited the pool with one of the original tile artists and has this story.
Christy Simonson walks to the end of the women's locker room at the Augustus Brown pool. She points to one of the hand-painted tiles on the shower wall.
So this is mine.
Simonson was working as a lifeguard in 1999. The second and third graders needed help painting tiles, so she and her sister Marta volunteered.
We went out there to help the kids come in and pick out tiles and ideas and kind of help them through it. And there were a couple extra tiles, and they said, "Do you guys want to paint?" So my sister and I did.
Those tiles have lined the locker room showers for more than 20 years. Simonson's tile has streaks of green across a dark blue sky.
It looks like I did some northern lights on the horizon, which I still love to this day.
Her sister painted stick figures swimming in a pool lane and wrote, "I love to swim at 4:45 a.m., a nod to their early morning high school swim practices.
So there was like snow blizzards we were driving through in the pitch black, freezing cold, to come swimming in the pool for an hour before high school would start. It was just kind of a sarcastic joke because no one really loves doing that, but we love the sport and being with the team, so it was worth it.
Simonson's love of the sport started early.
I tried out for swim team when I was six, so in 1985. And basically from then until 99, I was here. It was my life.
She built a community around the teammates, coaches, coworkers, and Juno residents who visited the pool every day. She taught swim lessons for kids. One summer, she led aerobic activity classes for seniors.
They would be in the pool, I would be on the deck, we would do a workout routine and kind of listen to some music as we went back and forth with the exercises, but it was just a great way from a teenager's perspective to connect with like the seniors in the community and develop a relationship.
In the remodeled lobby, high-resolution photos of the original tiles will sit alongside new art. Last month, the city asked kids to submit drawings of their favorite experiences at the pool. Simonson hopes the new generation of artists will look back fondly on their artwork and the pool like she does. She says it's kind of like a church.
Just a sanctuary for people to come and exercise and kind of let your stresses go. Or maybe, you know, if you've had a bad day, come exercise or come sit in the sauna. And it's just a place where you can bring your kids and then your kids' kids come. And it's nice.
The Augustus Brown pool will remain closed until at least the end of the year. In the meantime, Juno residents can swim at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center in the Mendenhall Valley. In Juno, I'm Katie Anastas.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Wesley Early in Anchorage, Robin in Fairbanks, Francisco Martinez-Cuello in Bethel, Tom Bonsi in Nakata, Washington, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Brian Venois in Kodiak, and Katie Anastas in Juneau. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.